I'm Dr. Brian Goldman, host of the CBC podcast, The Dose. Each week, we answer health topics in a smart and sometimes counterintuitive way you won't hear anywhere else. Like, what's the least amount of exercise I can do to get the benefits? Which psychedelics can improve my mental health? And how can I check for cancer if I don't have a family doctor? Top experts help me bring you what you need to know in plain language in about 20 minutes. Find The Dose on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Nora Young. This is Spark. Tell me, what does it mean to be human in this particular technological moment? It can seem like conventional measures of what's true, permanent, and, well, human are up for grabs in the face of rapidly advancing tech. And if there's no special spark that truly separates us from other animals or our technological creations, does it matter? That's what we'll try to answer in our 10-part series, Being Human Now. This time, play. Think back to when you were a kid. Where did you play? We had this ravine near our house where the neighborhood kids would get together. The best part was playing on the rope swing that crossed the stream. Whatever your childhood memories are, I bet a lot of them have to do with playing. It's how we learn about the world and ourselves. Play helps us develop creativity, confidence, and social skills. But somewhere along the road to adulthood, play starts slipping down the ladder of priorities in our lives. Many of us even stop calling it play as though we've outgrown the word. Instead, we say hobbies, recreation, or leisure.
That idea of leisure, we've talked about it as an illusion because can we ever truly be fully detached from work or responsibility? So leisure in its purest sense is this kind of playful vivaciousness of experience that allows you to be in your body and yourself fully, and you do it for the sake of doing it as opposed to doing it for a credit, doing it for money, doing it for a gain in a relationship. My name is Kim Lopez. I work as an assistant professor at the University of Waterloo in the Faculty of Health.
Kim is also the 2020 recipient of the Emerging Leisure Scholar Award from the Canadian Association for Leisure Studies. But ask her what she does, and she doesn't stop with work.
Some of my interests are hanging out with my family and exploring new spaces and going to community centers and watching my kid run around the track and walking my dog. Those are the things that I really enjoy. And that's my live for the weekend little spiel as well.
It's easy to dismiss time away from our professional or personal obligations as unproductive or use our leisure time just to feel rejuvenated enough to prepare for work. But time that feels fully free has a tremendous impact on all parts of our lives.
That's everything that we kind of strive towards, that time that we have to ourselves with the people we love and doing the things that we enjoy doing. So I think that once we have the free time and space to invest in that part of our lives, the rest of our lives really are able to flourish.
And yet, instead of flourishing for many of us,
leisure has been something that we felt that we needed to earn, but we all have a right to and access to leisure. I believe it's one of the United Nations core principles, that we all have a right to rest, leisure, and a healthy life.
A right to rest and leisure. You're not alone if you're thinking, sure, maybe someday. Because even when you try to carve out time for it, it doesn't quite feel like it did when you were a kid running around at the park, not a care in the world. It may be hard to believe, but public playgrounds weren't always the norm. It was something that basically had to be invented as a response to industrialized urbanization in the early 1900s.
So the playground movement was established by a group of women who recognized that there was a need for kids and families to occupy spaces in their communities that was separate from school, and for them to gather and connect over something that was pure play. And so in that movement, we saw that children could be their best selves when they were in structured play, these spaces of unrestrained, free expression and exploration, what allowed children to fully kind of form as independent human beings in different ways.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I sort of took playgrounds for granted, but I live not far from the first public playground in Toronto. And it seemed like it was a relatively recent creation, like turn of the 20th century.
Yeah, well, it was a response to folks who were often poor and marginalized in society in many ways, having access to that space where leisure was often reserved for the elite.
Right.
And so this came as a response to them needing respite from those long work days and creating positive morale. So community centers, recreation facilities, the opportunity to engage over a meaningful activity with low cost really kind of allows those communities to come alive and enrich those spaces with, you know, vitality and passion and connection between people.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to learn more about your research on digital access to leisure during the pandemic in particular. So first of all, can you give me some examples of the types of accessibility you were investigating?
The project came out of a need to understand older adults and their engagement with technology and how they were navigating technology and the need for more technology during the pandemic. And often we found that older adults kind of fell into one of two major groups. They were open and adopting of the new technologies, willing to kind of explore and play to enable themselves to continue to do the activities that they like to do, or folks who were interested in kind of pursuing activities offline and really needing to be creative in the offline space. But for the research that we were interested in, we were looking at how folks were using technology as a means to maintain their social connections, either with family or with friends, in really interesting and creative ways. For example, grocery deliveries, the apps that people were using to pick up their groceries or order takeout or connect to their churches and church communities, to listen to audiobooks or live readings that they were using, or even to gather for dinner. I knew of one couple that was part of a dinner group that they would meet up with couples every weekend, but during the pandemic, they couldn't do that. So instead, there were seven couples that would meet online and they would order using their phones through an app to a place, a restaurant, and they would all receive food from that restaurant and then have conversation online. So they were able to maintain their dinner club through Zoom and other online platforms.
Yeah. During the pandemic, my father, who was at the time in his late 90s, learned to use video chat, which was an interesting experience walking him through that. But because he saw the value of the connection, like it really, he was always very sort of anti the internet. But because he could see that connection to leisure, to pleasure, to family, it suddenly became something that he wanted to engage in.
Yeah, well, I mean, we can't discount the importance of face-to-face connection. And I think things like Zoom and FaceTime and Skype allowed us to do that. And while we were already doing it pre-physical distancing, I felt that the pandemic really showed us that it was really necessary for us to deepen and maintain those connections. And technology was an opportunity for us all to do that more deliberately and with intentionality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So beyond the pandemic, how is today's digital technology changing the ways we think about and the ways we experience leisure?
Mm-hmm. I think we're still feeling a few aftershocks from the pandemic in terms of technology, and we're really learning how to work with it in an integral way because we're still ramping back up into in-person spaces, but we're not wanting to let go of that privilege, the privileges that technology has afforded us. So telecommuting, people are feeling less inclined aligned to commute long distances when there's a readily available opportunity to meet online. I've often talked to people about how people are more readily able to show up in spaces online, even for leisure gatherings and, you know, friendly gatherings, and feel safe in terms of, you know, not spreading illness and that type of thing. So I feel like we're, you know, trying to work with this space, but also attempting to kind of sprinkle in those in-person moments. I feel like people are still emerging from what was this very technologically demanding space, and we're trying to redefine ourselves as both physical and technological beings simultaneously.
But are there any downsides to that? Like, if we get used to ordering our groceries online and we don't even have to see the person who's delivering them, you know, in terms of our leisure and interpersonal communications, is there a downside to that digital connection?
I certainly think it's changing. I'm not sure if it's a downside, but some people may perceive it as that, because a lot of people's spontaneous connections happen through the activities of daily living, going to the bank and talking to the teller, or meeting somebody at the checkout, and those types of, you know, happenstance interactions that are very leisurely are changing for sure. But those affordances are allowing us to do other things, freeing up our time to engage in leisure in different ways. And I think that possibility is very exciting as well.
Mm-hmm. Our digital devices let us engage in leisure activities anytime, anywhere, but they also make it really tempting to respond to work requests outside of work hours. What do you make of all this kind of intertwining and overlapping of work and leisure?
This is where we need to get better, in my opinion, I think. We are finding that our technological devices are an extension of ourselves because they're so easily accessible. Now they're becoming wearable. They're watches. They're even rings. They're monitoring everything that we do all the time. When we think about, you know, exercise even becoming something that we're needing to quote unquote achieve in our day-to-day life as part of work that we do, right? So, I mean, I think it's really difficult to say that we clock out at a certain time because it's so a part of our online ethos, right? We can't disentangle that. But I think we're getting better almost at integrating leisure into work more so. So I think we're becoming a little bit more sensitive to, I really need a break right now. I'm going to scroll on TikTok for a few minutes, or I'm going to chat up my friend over here, you know, on a video chat for a little bit. I think technology allows us to also do the reverse and integrate moments of leisure in our workday, potentially just as easily as it goes the other way around. But I do feel that we need to be a little bit more bounded in our work relations online for sure.
Previously on Spark.
So even if we don't want to conduct our own experiments, is it important for us to understand how these incentives work?
Why don't you want to run your own experiment? It's fun.
Okay, you sold me.
You are listening to Spark from the CBC.
I'm Nora Young, and right now my guest is leisure expert Kim Lopez. We're talking about how play is changing now that so much of our lives are digital. We fall into our phones, watching reels or playing games, engaging in passive amusement rather than active play. And with so much happening on our all-consuming digital devices, it's becoming increasingly difficult to disentangle work from play or draw set lines between them.
Adults are really resistant to this word of play.
Yeah.
Society has created this almost stigma around adult play, because when we're not working, we're playing, and somehow that's seen as not useful or productive or respectable as an adult, right?
Yeah.
So I think that we need to kind of break that down. We've talked about how in different cultures, they don't even have the word leisure. They have other words like living the good life. It's a more holistic approach to living in the world where we don't have this segmentation between needing to be productive through this thing called labor or work and this need to release and have respite through this thing called leisure or free time or unobligated time. They don't even have that kind of language.
Wow. Can you talk a bit more about how our understanding of leisure varies across cultures?
It's interesting because I've done some work with folks who have recently migrated to Canada and North America specifically, because we have such a different relationship with work. I think folks also have such a different relationship with leisure. They feel that because we have this hyper focus on work, we need to create more bounded spaces of leisure, and they need those spaces of leisure more so than they need in other areas of the world where leisure is an integral part of living. And there's not that differentiation and binary between work and leisure. So for example, you know, there are a lot of cultures who take siestas and 2-hour lunches, and they have more vacation time, or they have better leave policies that are built into work. Just taking leaves are not looked down on in certain cultures. Mm-hmm. So we don't see this need to devalue or really stigmatize leisure in those cultures because they see it as necessary and an integral part of their lives.
Yeah. So is there a sense of how much leisure or play we should be getting on a daily basis?
I wouldn't want to prescribe that, but certainly I've heard the rule of thumb is, you know, 8 hours of sleep, 8 hours of work, and then 8 hours of leisure. But who really gets that perfect split, right? I don't know how all that many people who sleep 8 hours, and I certainly know a lot of people who work more than 8 hours a day.
Yeah.
And that obviously changes on what the day of the week is and what time of the year it is and all that other stuff too, and what their relations are in their family and friendship lives, right? So, you know, leisure isn't this time that we say, okay, well, I'm clocking out and everything else is unobligated. I think there's a lot of gray area when it comes to work and leisure, like, you know, caregiving or caring. Is that leisurely time? Is that work time? Could it be both?
Yeah. Or even making a meal. I mean, that can be leisure or it can be an obligation or both in a way. Yeah. But what if I'm sort of procrastinating or I'm stressing about the future? I mean, I'm not technically working, I'm not sleeping, but does that still count as leisure?
That's a good question. I like to think of it as, you know, unburdened, unobligated time. So I feel like that procrastination or, you know, planning, while it could maybe some take a lot of, you know, enjoyment in that, there are some folks that don't. So I think it's one of those things too, that some might call leisurely, but some definitely do not. But I do feel that planning or the procrastination piece is very laborious for us. And it often includes what we hope to do for our career aspirations and work. And that often is quite laborious.
Are there good versus bad forms of leisure?
Well, yeah, I guess so. Again, the good and the bad is very subjective for sure. But there are, you know, authors in our field that talk about this thing called dark leisure or purple leisure, leisure that's not necessarily considered the norm or even socially acceptable. For all the, you know, true crime fans that are out there, people will see people who engage in those unlawful acts as leisurely, the people who are committing those things. When they choose to do that in their unobligated time, they've chosen to do, you know, a crime or something like that. But there's things like smoking or vaping or other, you know, what we frame as unhealthful acts that can be considered by the user to be very leisurely. You know, you can connect over and spend time outside and do all of these things if you're smoking, for example. But that's, while it's unhealthful, it's still kind of this movement towards creating space for oneself by the person who is taking up that activity. So it's that really delicate juggle, or that interesting juggle of freely chosen activity, but is it also a healthful? So is that considered bad? I don't know. It's really up to the person who's engaging in that act, right?
Yeah, interesting. Do you think we really know how to have free time anymore, at least in North America? I mean, I'm thinking about how so many of us just end up on our phones scrolling away the evening on social media, or we have these tiny little leisure snacks in the day without really decompressing, or we have a work culture where you don't just, you know, go out for a coffee with your colleague and sit and talk and enjoy the good life.
Yeah, I love that phrase that you use, like leisure snacks, just like little bits and pieces of leisure just to sustain ourselves and sustain our soul. I don't know. I think that, again, that is an individual thing. I feel like we have things like burnout and we have things like exhaustion and, you know, the need to push through to get to this other side. And I think we need to do as a society better at recognizing those early signs to that need for fulfillment sooner than burnout, sooner than exhaustion, sooner than the weekend, because we as humans are complicated beings, right? We need that sustenance throughout the day and throughout our lives. It can't just come in our golden years or in the evenings or the weekends. It has to be in moderation throughout our day and in our lives. So I think we just need to be more sensitive to our need for leisure, for sure.
Yeah. And just finally, what would you suggest for anyone struggling to get into that kind of flow state or escape the mindset that values their working self more than their playful self? Are there ways to connect with your leisure-loving self?
Yeah, I think about the things that brought me joy when I was a child, like picking up a paintbrush that you haven't, or like having a chat with your friends that wasn't bounded by the start of your next meeting. What is that thing that allows you to be completely connected to something, yourself or another person? How do we get back to that? And I think we have to remember when those moments of passion or pure joy really were a central part of your life. And often that comes back to childhood, you know, where we felt really unobligated in a lot of different ways, perhaps some more than others. But what is that spark that brings you joy? And how do we, you know, make that more centered in our lives? That's a hard question, because you're right. I don't think we do have or make the space for ourselves to explore that. But it does take practice like anything else. I think we place so much emphasis on cultivating our craft for our careers or cultivating craft for our passion projects and that type of thing. But when it comes to taking a breath and not having, you know, the next minute or minutes scripted for ourselves, I think that's where the real challenge is. So yeah, in some ways, leisure is laborious in figuring out who we are as leisure beings as well.
Yeah, it's so interesting that you say about that sort of taking the time to do that. Like I find for myself on my walks to work, I have to remind myself that this is actually an opportunity to do something that I really like doing and like that I like looking at trees or whatever, that it's not just about like marching to the office as quickly as I possibly can. It is that bringing to mind the importance of paying attention to the pleasure that you're getting out of that experience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mindfulness is really important in that experience too. We are able to access that flow experience when we're attuned to what we're thinking about and, you know, the thing that we're focused on doing. So, you know, just making sure that we have space in our very cluttered minds to really attend to the thing that we love and brings us the most joy.
Kim, thanks so much for your insights on this.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me today.
Kim Lopez is an assistant professor in the Department of Recreation and Leisure Studies at the University of Waterloo.
From the Spark Archives, 2020, Regan Mandrick, Professor of Computer Science at University of Saskatchewan.
We know from a lot of research that games help us recover from stress, they help alleviate boredom, they help us socially connect to others, and they help us kind of self-manage our mood. So the social benefits, I think, are one that are really undersold. The other three that I generally talk about would be the cognitive benefits to executive function from playing certain types of video games. But then there are benefits to emotional self-regulation. So how we learn to, for example, deal with failure, how we learn to persevere in the face of obstacles, how we learn to graciously accept defeats, and how we learn to graciously win. Those are all these kind of life skills that games help teach us. And then the last one is really just about recovery from stress. We know that stress is a major part of our life, and the source of stress really is when we feel like we don't have control over our environment. That's when stress really starts to elevate, and gaming has really shown in many different ways to be a good way to recover from stress. I think people tend to think about games and have the stereotypical idea of, you know, a 16-year-old boy playing Call of Duty for 12 hours straight in the basement. And that's not really what games are.
Right.
Games span everything from those time filler games that you play on your phone. When we actually ask people, are you a gamer? A lot of people will say no. But when we ask them about, you know, do you play Candy Crush? Do you play Sudoku? Do you play Words with Friends? And they're, oh yeah, I play that regularly. So getting into gaming doesn't necessarily mean that you have to invest in, you know, an expensive console or a fancy computer. You can really just sign up on your smartphone and or similar and see a lot of the benefits.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Nora Young, and this time on Spark, another in our occasional series, Being Human Now. That's where we look at facets of human existence that we once took to be distinctly ours and how they're changing in today's technological moment. This time, play, and how our leisure and play activities change the more digital we are. And really, can we talk about play without taking a little trip to North America's playground? Yep, I'm talking about Las Vegas, city of over-the-top fountains, casinos, shows, fake international monuments, and now,
mind-blowing location-based entertainment experiences.
Location-based entertainment experiences, or LBEs.
My name is Winston Fisher. I am CEO of Area 15. We are an immersive entertainment district.
In Las Vegas, which I think most would argue is already itself an immersive entertainment district. But Area 15 is like a funhouse within that larger funhouse. Picture a 200,000 square foot building, kind of like a mall, but...
I hate the term mall, because we are so much more than a mall.
So, not a mall, but a really big mall-like building. Inside, everything is neon, like you're inside the movie Tron. When you enter...
We have retail on the left and the right. What we call retail is experiences such as Meow Wolf or axe throwing or barcade. Then we have event space in the back. There's music events, corporate events, yoga, you name it. Things going on all the time, and then series of really cool, fun things to do, like an overhead powered zip line when you walk through the door, or a ride called Liftoff that takes you up and down. We have augmented reality games, VR experiences.
If it sounds like a lot, it is.
This universe that we've created, sort of like the multiverse came to life in Las Vegas, is really a platform business for storytelling.
A physical experience, but with a digital overlay.
For us, digital is becoming more and more about customizing your digital experience and how do you consume that digital experience that you've customized when you're there physically. We do AR, but with write yourself into the story of Area 15, and then how does that become a customized AR game that you can play when you come there?
All over the world, the real one, not the smaller version in Vegas, location-based experiences like Area 15 have been popping up. From Dubai to England, brands are partnering with entertainment companies to create massive immersive experiences that are part retail, part circus, all to capitalize on the changing entertainment desires of consumers.
The old world was spectator, the new world is participant. And that for us is things are touchable in the most basic way, participatory with your friends, right? It's shared experience, shared energy, right? Like, I mean, people go through Meow Wolf alone, clearly, but they go through with groups a lot, right? Like when you go to a music show or a concert or a rave, you're a participant in your experience. You're helping define what your experience will feel and look like while you're there. So it's a participatory experience. It's not a, you know, walk in, buy ticket, we pulse you through, you do this. You can enjoy it almost however you want.
I do get the idea of participation. I mean, we've had participatory theater for ages, and doesn't play require active participation? Watching a movie can be entertaining or moving, but I wouldn't call it play. Still, what's the balance between enabling play with technology without tipping over into blinding techno spectacle that takes away from the humanity of play?
Technology is not a story. It's like saying, is the author a pen? No, the pen is the pen, right? It's only as good as who's writing it. So technology is a pen. It's a tool to tell the story. That said, things like how you do integration of projection mapping, hologram technology, there are pioneers like Disney and Universal changing how people will be consuming AR, consuming hologram technology. It's amazing. I love that stuff. I think AI is a game changer in terms of the ability for now small companies to be competitive against large companies, because it's probably would have taken, I don't know how many billions of dollars to talk about having an interactive comic book that people can write themselves into and that you can track all these wonderful things. That's off the shelf technology now. So technology is and AI are changing how you consume it. Tracking people, I think, is really interesting. I don't mean in a bad way, but that idea of individualizing an experience as somebody walks up. And if you talk about digital, physical, if you create a character in the digital world, can that character live with you in the physical world? And it's getting better, right? It's not getting novel. It's actually going to become much more seamless. That overlay will just become, you know, whether it's your phone or RFID, will be integrated into even, I think it's going to be integrated into, frankly, mall technology. When you go up to the kiosk, you should have an individual relationship with your digital guide to the space. That's all here and coming.
So what kind of impact does Winston think these kinds of technologies are having on the way we think about play and how we engage in play?
You know, it's opening our minds to a lot of different things. It's making us jaded because, you know, something hits us fast and then we expect more. I'd say the consumer's attention, it's harder, right? It's always the next thing, the next TikTok, the next this. But if you have really good storytelling, that is the counteracting to the, you can update the story to keep emotionally connected. All of that said, the physical is so important because we are disconnected. There are more Yelp warriors today than we care to count. There are people who are sharing constantly and you see things on your phone, but nothing replaces that feeling of all being together and celebrating and feeling that energy and shared experience. So if you can harness that digital, harness the technology, but make sure that you have emotional connection for how people are consuming it, it gets really interesting and it's timeless, right? You're not reinventing that people like to feel, smell, taste, jump up and down, be scared a little bit, have their adrenaline going, hug each other, celebrate together. That's actually tried and true.
Winston Fisher is the CEO of the Immersive Experiential Entertainment District, Area 15, in Las Vegas.
You are listening to Spark.
All right, no one go on the phone for the next half hour. I have to go on the internet.
This is Spark
from CBC.
I'm Nora Young, and today we're talking about play as part of our occasional series, Being Human Now. Play can mean different things to different people, of course, but for most of us, much of our leisure time is spent online. And that's led to an area of study called digital leisure.
Digital leisure, the way I look at it, and others who are trying to create a sort of a pushback against normative notions, is how you play with the rules of the game. And that particularly through the digital space that we have.
This is Pyle Arora. She's a digital anthropologist and a professor of inclusive AI cultures at Utrecht University. We spoke to Pyle in 2019 about her book, The Next Billion Users, Digital Life Beyond the West. In it, she explored the way young users in a number of countries in the global south actually use the internet as a way to counter preconceived notions in the West about how these users behave or should behave online. More recently, she was a field researcher in Brazil for the UNHCR, the UN's refugee agency, that produced a report called The Digital Leisure Divide and the Forcibly Displaced.
In the last decade, I've been looking at forcibly displaced populations, whether it's in Brazil, Bangladesh, and elsewhere. And one of the fundamental features that have crossed across board is that the way in which they use digital media is not utility driven as much as it's digital leisure driven, because these are fundamental spaces for self-actualization and feeds into their aspirations for a better future.
The report focuses on the digital experiences of Venezuelan refugees.
In the last few years, there's been a lot of disruptions in Venezuela, which has led to a massive exodus, you know, of a lot of marginalized populations from there to the borders of Brazil, seeking for a good life. And many of them have also been forcibly displaced. So it's a combination of both. And these are patterns that are not unique to this context, but is being experienced everywhere in the world, right, in many ways. So some interesting patterns on top of that is they are substantively young and they are driven by aspirations for a better life, and they are much more adept at using digital media tools in ways that haven't been captured.
And yet, when it comes to how aid agencies try to meet the digital needs of refugees and displaced populations, they seem to ignore the importance of play and focus exclusively on more utilitarian uses of digital devices and platforms.
There's this sort of divide between the North and South as, well, they have different usage patterns because they come from such extraordinarily different contexts. And this is a sort of a perpetuation of thinking and practice that seeps into policy and design. But in many ways, you know, my research has shown on the contrary, despite these extraordinarily different contexts, many of them are driven by the same kind of things that you and I are driven by, which is they're seeking for love and companionship. Kids are obsessed by, you know, games, and parents, even in the settlements, are like, I cannot control these kids. We have such limited data, and all they do is play games. And that sounds like any parent who would be complaining in, like, right, you know, Boston or Amsterdam, wherever. So, of course, the consumption of sexual content, you know, I mean, after all, a lot of them are teenagers and they're trying to discover their sexuality, you know, menstruating for the first time, all these things. And they are looking for outlets of how do they understand their bodies, their drives. And so all this is very extraordinarily mundane, but what's interesting is that we did not allow that to enter into the imagination of the entire populations in the global south, because we either over-romanticize them as virtuous beings, you know, who somehow will use digital media to be very utilitarian, you know, like they will learn math and English and find jobs and even chemistry. I mean, you know, the popular hole in the wall project from a decades ago, like, was really celebrated. In fact, won a TED award for saying that, you know what, kids will just run to computers and learn chemistry. And This has been proven. Even Bertrand Russell, when he established this experimental school in the 1920s, he came up with this idea that, oh, if kids would just be given free rein, how they would learn all this knowledge. But in the end of the day, you know, after 6 months, he closed shop and said, well, given a choice between climbing a tree and, you know, doing math, they'll climb a tree.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, and I think that's something beautiful is that, well, there is a humanity, a shared humanity here. And so we have to understand that. But of course, what stories they say on TikTok, what kinds of experiences they narrate, what are their struggles, are of course unique to their experiences based on their conditions and context, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, yeah. So what are some of the assumptions that aid agencies have about displaced people and how that affects their approach to the kind of digital interventions they do in those communities?
Well, one is, of course, like I said, very utility driven, that they would be doing the good things online, right? And God forbid if they do something which is, you know, not good, like watch porn. They cannot justify to funders that, oh, we managed to get them connectivity so they can watch porn, right? And so they absolutely need to disregard that. But then also there's so much fear that, oh, they're going to do something which is unpalatable under their jurisdiction. So it's much more surveyed and policed. And the expectations are much more about you need to do something useful and you need to speak in developmental terms. So it's sort of a catch-22. So refugee populations are smart enough to catch on and they feed into these sort of fictional narratives that then quickly gets written up. So I think that there is sort of a deep complicity of perpetuating a particular system so as to continuation of funding. Also, what's disturbing is the kind of questioning that one tends to receive, and often well-meaning, by the way. Just recently, I was at an interdisciplinary workshop and I was giving a talk, and a woman who's been in the field in aid agencies for more than 30 years said, you know, I'm having a real moral struggle here because I've been really trying to connect the unconnected for so long. And now I wonder, is it right for me to do that? Because what am I doing? I'm bringing all these people online so they can be extracted, so they can be oppressed by corporations, so they can be abused by corporations, and I will be held responsible. And, you know, I was like, the fact that it's a choice whether to bring them online or not versus connectivity being a right, right?
Yeah.
And so I think this is a difficult terrain we're in, where we are so used to hearing all the, you know, negatives about being online that what we are forgetting is that there's this conversation happening right now in many parts of the world, something like 2+ billion people who are in some way forcibly, you know, displaced and growing exponentially because of climate crisis and inequality and war, is that we are even asking these questions. Because nobody would even dream of imagining us asking this question of, oh, Google is terrible, OpenAI is terrible, so let's all get off the internet. Right? I mean, like, that would not even be seriously considered. What we are trying to focus on for at least users in the West, or, you know, on want of a better term, is better guardrails, you know, more accountability, responsible design. These are the kinds of conversations. So why can't we have a more unified conversations across board, incorporating all populations?
Mm-hmm. So are the assumptions that you're describing about kind of the sort of worthy things that people ought to be using the technology for, are those assumptions also shared by the tech companies that are building the technology that's essential to digital ledger?
No, actually, on the contrary, if any entity is most open to these user groups, shall I say, are tech companies, actually, and for their own vested interests, because we are in an AI age, we are in a data-driven economy. And the fact is 90% of young people live outside the West. Just India and China alone constitute the majority of users, and they haven't even reached market saturation. Sub-Saharan Africa is the fastest growing young population group in the world. And by 2040, they will become the majority. So, you know, including the fact that these populations have come online because in the last decade, there have been radically different data plans and cheap mobile phones that have enabled them to come online and be active and shape the internet in ways, right, that has been unforeseeable in the past. We've really gone past the whole digital divide narrative. So they are very excited with this prospect because more data allows them to build stronger AI. And in the AI arms race, right, it's all a matter of who has more data. So companies are enthusiastic about it. And also they recognize digital leisure as fundamental drivers in generating data. In fact, a company, Jio, right, which is an Indian-based company funded by Reliance, this multi-billionaire corporation and headed by Ambani, basically came up with a marketing principle for their new telecom services, particularly targeting marginalized, resource-constrained young people. And it was the ABCD principle, because what they did was just look at the data of what people were, you know, pivoting it for and recognize that much of what they were using the data was for four things: astrology, Bollywood, cricket, and devotion content. And so they said, if you can tap into those four buckets, you know, which make up almost 80% of the content, we've got these people. So that's really underlining it. Of course, that goes without saying is that there's a different conversation with corporations, is what's their responsibility towards these populations. And this is a conversation happening right now because of OpenAI, is, you know, what constitutes as fair value, particularly for the so-called public data commons, you know, being usurped by private entities. How does value get reshifted to the public domain? Because it is being extracted for private profiteering, etc. But that's, again, another conversation. But like I said, at least they are, you know, pivoting. And the question is, are they also using that data to build tools which will work for these populations? And that's a different conversation.
This is Spark.
Yeah, hi. It's Nora Young calling. I just wanted to make sure you knew we started at the usual time today.
100 questions? 100 questions!
I don't believe that cats are actually the most important, greatest thing on the internet.
Hold on.
I'm a dining chair.
I'm a coffee table.
I've always thought of you as a coffee table, Michelle.
100 questions.
You're listening to Spark from your friends at CBC Radio.
I'm Nora Young. Today on Spark, we're talking about play and leisure. Right now, my guest is Pyle Arora, a Netherlands-based digital anthropologist. Her research focuses on digital use among populations in the global south and marginalized groups. I mentioned that in this UNHCR report, you talked to Venezuelan refugees in Brazil. Are there some other examples that you have of the ways that forcibly displaced communities are using digital technologies specifically for leisure activities?
Well, the other major rise is the creator economy, which also ties with the way in which digital payments are being exercised and how content is being monetized. So like in Europe right now, you know, the idea of data as currency, I think, makes people spiral into some sort of, like, they start frothing and they're like, oh my God, how could we possibly, you know, allow that to happen? But in many parts of the world, that's actually empowerment, because if you don't have anything else, data is something that you can exchange for value for yourself, which is access to data, right? So I think it is really important to understand in relation to what, right? And also the choices people make are driven by their own context and conditions. So going to the creator economy, in the last few years, the pandemic has really impacted many parts of the world. And even though we seem like we have moved on, it has destroyed a lot of conventional industries because they couldn't stay afloat. They weren't as privileged, like, Europe to get bailout money, or like in the US in many ways, right? So they weren't getting these paychecks. So many of these small mom and pop shops and entrepreneurs just lost a lot of funding. And so it was this easy way to get online and try to monetize and also to build some kind of alternative form of livelihood. And you see that happening, particularly amongst refugee populations that don't need a physical space like an office, or, you know, they can operate on the go, basically, right? They can even make their own struggle and narrative part of their content stream. So we see a lot of that happening. There's this whole genre, even on the creator economy, right, on leveraging on this, shall we say, poverty porn, but in a different kind of way. It's a fresh poverty porn, not to make people feel depressed, but more about, look at me, I'm in a village and I'm dancing to Beyonce and, you know, in my rags. And yes, it is a sort of a disturbing narrative, but it's also playing that sort of audience so you can get some kind of support financially, right? So there's a lot of tactics, shall we say, of survival, which goes into what leisure is, which, you know, if you look into the history of leisure practice, it has always been deeply political. I mean, you know, from 1900s, even the notion of coming up with a public park, whether in New York or Shanghai or any of these parts, is tied so deeply into access for different populations and allowing different populations to inhabit common space. And that was a deeply radical act, you know, of democracy.
Yeah. So there's this sort of tactical use that you're talking about. Can you talk a bit about some of the other opportunities that present themselves to users when they're able to be online and be connected recreationally?
Yeah, so some of the side benefits is learning in different languages and also connecting with people from very different cultures. So building their social capital beyond their very small world that they oftentimes are inhabiting. Maybe they will never leave their slum, or maybe they'll never leave their settlement, because contrary to what the average person thinks, is these refugees will just sort of resend to a particular context and then they'll get settled down. Oftentimes it's multi-generations. This is their home. They stay in these settlements and then their children are born there. So it's, in a sense, it's like a forced gated community, right? So in those contexts, right, it is really important that they already start to think about their future as being very much, you know, embedded in these contexts, right?
Mm-hmm. Your report for the UNHCR came out a couple of years ago now, and I'm wondering if you've seen a change in how aid agencies approach digital technology use for displaced people.
So I think it's a struggle, particularly because what they have is evidence of a graveyard of apps, because what they've done is like, well, okay, we understand they're driven by leisure, for instance, but we need to do something which is utility driven. So let's do edutainment apps. Let's do a mobile health and edutainment, anything and entertainment, right? So combining these forces, and then they die a quick death because the project gets over, people download these apps, and then the next grant cycle starts. And so I think one of the things is, let's stop trying to push people to going somewhere else, but recognize that, yes, they are inhabiting some common spaces like Instagram and Facebook. And how do we then leverage on these spaces, however we may perceive them to be toxic, right? But these are their realities, that this is a space which is easy to enter. It has a staying power because it's not going to change anytime soon. And how do you build infrastructures and institutions, which is like no small feat, because we also are seeing conversations like Facebook against Australia, where it says, you know what, we're getting out of here because you try to push us to paying publishers. And so we're going to get out. And actually, technically, they can, just like Elon Musk can say tomorrow, I'm not going to let Ukraine use with my satellite. So these are the dangers we have, is that today the digital leisure spaces that are fundamental to self-actualization of humanity lies and is built on not just the platforms, but the very infrastructures which are privately owned, right? Which is underground water cables, which are fueling data centers. All this is privatized, and satellites. Mm-hmm. And so these are the kinds of conversations which are beyond the scope in some sense of a lot of these agencies, isn't it?
Yeah. Payal, thanks so much for your insights on this.
Yeah, of course. And thanks for the invite. It's a very important conversation. I'm glad you're hosting it.
Payal Arora is a digital anthropologist and professor of inclusive AI cultures at Utrecht University. You've been listening to Spark. The show is made by Michelle Parisi, Samarie Johannes, Megan Carty, and me, Nora Young, and by Kimberly Lopez, Winston Fisher, and Payal Arora. And from the Spark archives, Regan Mandrick. Subscribe to Spark on the free CBC Listen app or your favorite podcast app. I'm Nora Young. Talk to you soon.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.